I went to see Mr. Bickle, who was a glider pilot, had just set the new world's record for altitude in gliders. And Paul's gig was to sit back in his chair. He had this great big gut. He had a white shirt on every day, and he smoked a cigar. He'd, you know, flick the cigar, and the cigar ashes go on his shirt. You want to get up and come across the desk and wipe the cigar. And he said, okay, Joe Henry. He called me Joe Henry. He said, did you roll the airplane on your last flight? I said, yes, sir, I did. And he said, why? And I told him, huh. And he said, I'd have done the same damn thing, but don't do it again. Everybody will want to do it. And sure enough, it turned out when they found out back at ops, you know, that I wasn't going to get thrown off the base for rolling the X-15 on the first flight. They said, well, you son of a gun, I really wanted to roll that airplane, but now I can't. But there wasn't any rule that said you can't. But the answer is yes.
Thanks for sharing that. Thanks, Joe. You know, but where I was going with that is the training that all gave us as test pilots to learn these machines that were in parts of envelopes that we'd never been before, that yeah. applied directly to what went on for training for like the low approach on 10 and the landing on 11. What did you use for different training devices to do the missions between 8, 9, 10, and 11? Tell us a little bit about the training.
The trainer itself was a good systems trainer, and it taught you the priorities of things you need to keep your eye close on during a flight and the things that you can use as a kind of a secondary failure that happens. But the landing training, the thing you're talking about, looking out the window because you have no needles, no guidance with the X-15, to look out the window and just get yourself back over the runway and then set up the approach and landing. We used F-104s because in the F-104, it actually is about the same length as the X-15, and the wingspan's not too much different. And if you came to idle with the 104, put the speed brakes out, put the flaps down to takeoff position, and put the landing gear down, then you could get it to fly almost as bad as the X-15 to glide. And that was a really good trainer, because we could go uprange to all the uprange lake beds, set up from different positions. What if the engine quits here? You know,
yeah.
Do I try to stretch it onto the next dry lake bed, or pull it around and get rid of the fuel and get into the one I'm over?
And then down at NASA, Mike, when you were doing the dockings, you had I would presume you had simulators just for doing the rendezvous and docking phase. When you were flying Columbia, you were the active piloting ship for the docking, is that right? How did that come about?
Well, our training was exhaustive, I would say. I think in the command module simulator, I had over 600 hours in that. So by the time we got airborne, things were not strange to us. I mean, the environment was strange, but the mechanical aspects of it were just like old so-and-so used to tell me, Collins, you idiot, don't do this, you know, in the simulator. And so it was the tasks that we were required to perform. I don't know about the lunar landing and the descent and the touchdown. You'd have to ask Buzzer, and I'm sorry, you can't ask Neil about that. But the stuff that I was in charge of was pretty simple stuff compared to what Joe was doing in the X-15.
When we docked Space Shuttle, we used the guidance and attitude hold for roll, pitch, and yaw, and all we worried about was translating up, down, left, right, and the speed in and out. Is it the same on a pod?
I think it was, and you know, I had to separate, and that was pretty much, you know, maybe I had to tweak the readings a little bit, but then the turnaround was pretty much a computer thing, and then coming back in, when you get within, you probably know better than I do from air-to-air refueling,
yeah.
When you get into 10 feet, 5 feet, 4 feet, then it's all our system at least was all mechanical.
Yeah.
You had to just get these two things lined up, and it wasn't a difficult thing, but it had to be done without an error or you'd bounce off, and then it would be much messier to try to get back into position.
How about the lander training vehicle? When you backed up on 10, did you do some of that, Joe?
No, I never got to fly.
So there. Did either of you get a debrief from Neil's training when he had to eject from the training vehicle?
I did not get a debrief from Neil.
I'm sorry, I missed the question.
When Neil had to eject from the LLTV,
yeah.
Did he debrief the crew, you guys? Did Neil debrief you on the LLTV?
No. I mean, Neil took that in stride. I'm sure he debriefed the LLTV people, but, so the story went, he went back to his office and his desk and picked up the administrative strands of his life as if the crash had never happened. And I don't know if that's true or false, but I would not be surprised if it were true. He was a pretty cool character. He took things in stride.
So people have noticed that your Apollo 11 patch was quite unique. Can we show the patch from Apollo 11?
Oh, I see it. It's over your right shoulder.
So would you mind? So I handed that off to somebody else and I didn't worry about it. This is a very unique patch for many reasons, and no crew names on there. And people talk about the symbolism of that. How did you guys come up with this patch?
Well, I guess it started with Gemini 10. John Young's wife really designed the patch and then turned it over to the two of us. And between us, we decided that we did not want any names on it, that rather than the two of us who were going to fly Gemini, we wanted to honor the, later on they called it 400,000 Americans in the early days of Gemini, probably half that, but that's still a slew of people. You try to put 200,000 people's name on a patch. And so we decided to go without it, and then one thing led to another. I more or less designed the Apollo 11 patch. And same reasoning there, that at that time there were 400,000 Americans. And so I like going into MOCR, you know, Mission Control, yep. In Houston. All is lined with patches, and I think, I'm not sure, but I think Gemini 10 and Apollo 11 are the only two without crew names.
Fantastic. Thank you.
Thank you.
Any memories about the surface of the moon from orbiting that you'd want to share?
I really don't. The back of the moon is a little bit different. It doesn't have the maria, you know, the flat thing they call seas. Terrain identical almost to that where Neil was able to put Eagle down. It's more craggy, more beat up, more fissures, more peaks that you don't expect, more of an uneven surface. But you know, what do you expect? I don't know, little green men or something? It's pretty much, what you would expect, having seen the front part of the moon. Just like I say, it doesn't have the Mari and it's a little more beat up, but you've seen the front, you almost have seen the back, and so whatever.
That's fantastic.
Thank you.
So before you came out, we showed a video of the descent to the touchdown with the alarms going off, 1201, 1202.
Yes.
And what strikes me is how young everybody was in the control center. You had Steve Bales and you had Jack Garman. In the back rooms, they had a list of all those alarms. And for those of you who didn't completely follow that, it wasn't a smooth descent. And they ended up with only 15 seconds of fuel, but they also were making these calls about, do we go or do we abort? And it was some gutsy calls there with guys like Jack and Steve instantly making a call that we're go. And you know, 25-year-old guys, and being that ready, it was pretty impressive. Any thing you want to share about that? Joe, you even mentioned that they gave him a special hat for his retirement with 1201 on it, I think, right?
No, it wasn't me. I didn't know
okay.
that, but it doesn't surprise me.
So how did you get debriefed about that after the fact, and how they went through that decision-making process?
Well, I was worried. I mean, I was a 1201 and a 1202. I think I have those beat into my head, and I wouldn't know one lunar module error code from another, trust me. But I started scrambling through my library, and I had an extensive library to try to find the right book and the right page to find what was 1201 or 1202. And about that time, a young guy in Mission Control in Houston he knew right away what it was, and he was willing to stick his neck out a little bit, I think, and say, go, flight, tell him go.
And your neck too.
Yeah, oh well. But no, he was willing to say it was a go, and flight director trusted him, and by that time perhaps the flight director and some other people were up to speed on the
what
implications of either a 1201 or a 1202. So down they went.
Awesome. There's a photo that we have of Neil. He had spent some time with us here at EAA as well, back around the 2004 time frame, and there's the photo of him on stage with us right here, and Neil came out and shared a lot of stories. This particular night, we actually made a link to the space station, audio link, where we could talk to the crew on the space station, and Neil spent the evening talking to us about the study he had done on the Wright brothers, because this was the 100th, just after the 100th anniversary of the Wright brothers' first flight.